Thank you, Boris. Thank you for inviting me, and I had a nice time meeting with some of you yesterday and today. So now I get to tell you a little bit about what we've been doing in my lab. And I'm going to tell you, it's going to be three little stories, which are, they're connected in sort of a bigger picture, but I think it's important to lay that out at the beginning, so if you sort of lose track of one of the stories, you can restart when I start the next story, so you won't be lost for the entire period. So to start out and just give you the overview and what these three stories all involve, they're all involved with signaling in bacteria, and in particular they're associated with two component signaling. And I know this is a diverse audience, and there's some real experts in the audience in this subject, and I apologize to them because there's some people I think who know nothing about this subject too, so I have to try and lecture to the entire crowd. So I want to start out by telling you about two component signaling. And this is one of the favorite means that bacteria use to sense and respond to their environment. So I've just thrown up some examples of signals which various bacteria use two-component signaling systems to sense. And these are some of the various processes within the cell that two-component systems regulate in various bacteria. And in fact, I think probably I've covered, or this almost covers everything in a cell, and probably just any process in a cell, you can find some bacterium that uses a two-component system to regulate it. There are lots of them out there. But what actually this is really just the process of adaptive responses or cell signaling. What defines two-component systems or two-component signaling is that at their core, at least in the simplest examples, they have two components. So there's a protein, which is a histidine kinase, which is usually associated with sensing, either directly or indirectly, these input signals, or one of these signals. And I like to think of it as sort of like a two device. It sort of has an off state and an on state. The on state is when it's phosphorylated. And then the second component is another protein called a response regulator, and it's also a two-state device. It can be unphosphorylated or phosphorylated. And information flow in this system is by phosphotransfer. So in particular, a activated histidine kinase, a phosphorylated histidine kinase, transfers its phosphate group to a response regulator, and in the process of doing that, it then loses the phosphate. So this is actually, for those of you who are familiar with other signaling systems, this is somewhat from many of the signaling systems, say in eukaryotes, where one activated component is often then a activated kinase and will use ATP as a source of phosphate to then phosphorylate a downstream protein. Here, the source of phosphate is directly from the protein itself, and so it turns off in the course of now activating the next downstream component. So the phosphorylated response regulator then carries out some kind of response. And in most of the examples that have been studied, the response is transcriptional, but there are certainly some exceptions, and particularly well-studied notable exception is the case of chemotaxis, which I'll briefly talk about at the end. So why are people interested in two-component systems? Well, they're extremely important for understanding microbial physiology. Just about any aspect of the physiology of a microbe, there's a good chance that two-component system it might be involved. Also for pathogenesis, there are many two-component systems that are important for controlling the behavior of pathogens to affecting their ability to cause disease in humans. So they're particularly important in that context. For me, the real attraction of these systems is that they provide a relatively simple and tractable class of systems for studying biological circuits. So they're a circuit in the sense that there's an input, there's an output, there's some kind of information processing that goes on, and there's a kind of broader long-term goal for people studying cell signaling, which is to try and understand, is there a circuit science for these systems? Can we come up with general principles for cell signaling? And the only way that we're going to do that is by studying lots of examples. And in particular, we need to look at some simple examples where we can actually modify the systems and model them and hopefully make some progress. And two-component systems are at least one nice set of examples. And in particular, there are lots and lots of examples, even in a single organism. So in E. coli, there are roughly 30 distinct two-component systems. Many of them have names, which means that it doesn't mean they know what they do. It means if there's a name, it presumably there was some kind of phenotype associated with the bacteria when they knocked out that system. They had some criteria for coming up with a name. In some cases, we think we know what the input signals are, although as I talk, I think even there, some of the systems where we think we know the signal, we may not. And in some cases, we know what the output is, but really, by far, on the whole, we don't know that much about most of the two-component systems, even in a well-studied organism like E. coli. So for me, this is sort of a playground in principle. The long-term fantasy is that can we compare and contrast different two-component systems and see what can we learn about why they have certain features in common, and also what are the reasons that they differ. So that the three systems I'm going to talk about are the MZ-OMP-R system. So in this case, the input signal, at least according to the textbooks, is osmolarity, so the amount of dissolved stuff in the medium. And at least among the outputs for this system, the best studied outputs are regulation of genes called porins, which regulate the outer membrane permeability. So essentially, at least what will be important for my talk is simply that there are genes that are regulated which control outer membrane permeability or permeability of the cell wall. Another example is the FOQP system. In this case, the input signals are conditions of low magnesium and also presence of certain cationic antimicrobial peptides. And the output for this circuit, there are a lot of genes which are regulated by this circuit, but not surprisingly, at least one of the genes is a high affinity magnesium transporter, which would make sense if it's turned on under conditions of low magnesium. Also, there are genes associated with modifying the outer membrane of the cell to protect it from these antimicrobial peptides, and there are a number of other genes for which it's not really understood at the moment why they're being regulated. And finally, the last system is a chemotaxis circuit. And in this case, the input are chemoattractant signals. This is a grossly oversimplified view of the chemotactic circuit, but there is a histamine kinase, and in fact, in this case, there are two response regulators. And the output is here not the regulation of gene expression. Here, it's the control of a rotary motor. So in particular, it controls whether the rotary motor is turning clockwise or counterclockwise. So to start out, I want to talk about the FOQP system, and the reason we got interested in this circuit is because among the genes that the FOQP circuit regulates include the genes for FOQ and FOQP themselves. In other words, it's an example of an auto-regulated circuit. The phosphorylated response regulator activates the promoter, which controls transcription of the gene for the response regulator and the histidine kinase themselves. And in fact, that seems to be a fairly common theme in two-component systems. I've just put up a couple other examples from that big list, but there are probably many more examples. It's just that either they weren't studied or I couldn't find any specific papers that identified those systems as being autoregulated. So this is a common theme, and it's generally assumed it's some form of positive feedback. It looks like positive feedback. So we know that positive feedback in regulatory circuits and in even outside of biology, positive feedback has a tendency to cause switch-like responses. And so my graduate student, Tim Miyashiro, started with a hypothesis, well, since this is an autoregulated circuit, he hypothesized like a switch. So in other words, as he stimulates the FOQP system, would say by dropping the magnesium concentration, he expected to see some kind of switch-like behavior as cells turn from an off to an on state. So how can you go about testing that? Well, whenever you're going to look at a question like that for a switch-like response, it's important to make measurements in single cells, because if as your population of cells are switching on, presumably they're not all going to switch on at the same time, and if you make an average over your population of cells, you won't necessarily see a discontinuous transition from an off to an on state. So to make measurements in single cells, he chose a selection of genes that are regulated by the FOQP system. And he engineered strains of E. coli in which he put two different reporter fluorescent proteins, yellow fluorescent protein and cyan fluorescent protein. He put the genes for these proteins in the chromosome. For cyan fluorescent protein, he put it under control of a reference promoter, which is not affected by the FOQP system. He also put the gene for yellow fluorescent protein in the chromosome. In this case, he put it under control of one of the genes he selected. So he looked at these four genes. He put it under control of one of these promoters for each strain. So in a single strain of E. coli, he can measure yellow fluorescence and he can measure cyan fluorescence. And he can, of course, take the ratio. And so the ratio gives a very sensitive measure of the activity of this promoter. And the beauty of taking the ratio is he removes lots of sources of variability from cell to cell, which have nothing to do with the FOQP signaling circuit. So this is just an example of a dose response curve where he grew cultures. These are cultures, it's measured at steady state and under different magnesium conditions, and he measures the yellow fluorescence, a ratio of yellow fluorescence to cyan fluorescence for these cultures. He does the measurements on the microscope. The fluorescence levels are quite low, so he has to use a microscope. It's below the sensitivity for flow cytometers and fluorometers, at least for some of these promoters. So he makes the measurements on the microscope, and then in software quantifies the amount of yellow fluorescence and cyan fluorescence for each cell. And here I'm reporting the average values he finds. And as expected, you see that all the systems turn on, all these genes, as you go to low magnesium. Just to give you a feel for the dynamic range, this is what happens if you delete FOQ, so the system is always off. You can also see the error bars are quite small. It's partly because he has very good hands, but it's also because he's taking the ratio again. He has that internal reference within his strain. And it's actually quite striking that the range, this response, at least for the average, is quite gradual over several log change in magnesium concentration. Mm-hmm. So steady state here is balanced growth. In other words, so the ideal idea of balanced growth is if you have an isolated bacterium in an infinite reservoir of media, so its own growth and metabolism is not affecting its environment. In reality, it means that we use low densities and we dilute them way back. So we dilute them back several times and never let them get the high optical density. Mm-hmm. No. This is not a switch behavior, but I would argue technically it's indeterminate at this point because I'm plotting the average over the population. However, this is now a plot of the histogram of single cells. So this is on this axis are number of cells. On this axis is the corresponding fluorescence signal. So for the biologist, this is analogous to what you'd get coming out of a flow cytometer. And I've shown you distribution for three ranges of magnesium. And as you can see, all the cells in the population for a fixed magnesium are doing essentially the same thing, within some width to the distribution, which is going to depend on any number of things, from stochasticity to gene expression to, in our case, probably just various experimental errors in making the measurements. But the bottom line is that we are not seeing a switch-like response, which would be a bimodal population. We'd have a population of off cells and on cells. So he was wrong. His hypothesis was disproven. We did not see a switch-like response. So this raises then the interesting question, why don't we see a switch-like response given this positive feedback? How does the circuit maintain this stable and remarkably graded output in the face of positive feedback? So to think about that, we did a little modeling of this system. And the first thing you realize is that was a grossly oversimplified picture of the positive feedback in this circuit. This is actually what the feedback loop should look like, because it was not this protein itself which regulates the promoter, it's the phosphorylated form. And the phosphorylated form is from this little circuit here. Another interesting point about this circuit, which I didn't mention at the beginning, is that not only is the histidine kinase, in this case FOQ, responsible for turning on FOP, it's also responsible for turning it off. So in fact, FOQ is a bifunctional enzyme. It's both a histidine kinase and it's a phosphatase. It also strips phosphate off of phosphorylated FOP, or at least activates a phosphatase activity.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we don't know the numbers for FOQ and FOP. We know they are in lower abundance. For another one, I know the numbers, 3,500 and 3,500. So in an analogous system, the MZ-OMPAR system, this is present in about 100 copies per cell, and this is about 3,500.
And so
is presumably, it's also, we know it's just anecdotally higher abundance than FOQ, but I can't say it's 35-fold higher in this system. Let's say it is 10-fold higher, I don't know. What were you?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm now going to show you, at least based on our models, you could not do that. But I think there was always, at least for some of these systems, I think it's generally been assumed you're never phosphorylating a significant fraction of the response regulators, at least for some of the systems. That's an interesting question. So yeah, that is correct. You'll find there were some early claims where it was thought this was the reverse reaction here, but there's some additional genetic work. First in MZ-OMP-R, and actually Eduardo Groisman did those experiments here too and showed that in fact it is not the reverse reaction. There are distinct catalytic, or they're thought to be distinct catalytic activities, although the domains I think are partially overlapping, or it's thought to be the case. So to make some progress, we wanted to think about this cycle of phosphorylation and dephosphorylation, and to do that we did a little bit of modeling. So we wrote down what I would argue is the simplest model you can write down that has all of the features that were known to be or expected to be present biochemically and genetically. So in particular, there's an autophosphorylation reaction for the histidine kinase. There's then transfer of the phosphate to the response regulator. There's then a phosphatase reaction where the phosphate comes off. And we've simply added two additional enzyme substrate complexes in this reaction because we want to allow the possibility of enzyme saturation. So that's the minimal way to achieve saturation of an enzyme, is by allowing for the presence of an enzyme substrate complex. So this is, I think, the simplest kinetic model for a circuit of this form. And what we did is that we then wanted to look at the steady state behavior. So it's just a bunch of algebraic equations for these concentrations. And the output, remember the output, we're viewing the output is the amount of phosphorylated response regulator. So in analyzing this, there are two constants with units of concentration which are effectively characteristic concentrations for the system. And we call them CP and CT. They're a little bit like Michaelis constants in Michaelis enzyme kinetics, but for the experts you can see they are not in fact Michaelis constants. And in particular, this constant CP, we expect to depend on the strength of the input signal. Because the input signal is presumably going to be changing the rate of autophosphorylation or the rate of dephosphorylation, or both. And you can see that CP depends on the ratio of those two rates. And so increasing stimulus will increase CP. So in analyzing this, there are several striking features. The first one, which comes back to Boris' question, is that at steady state, the amount of phosphorylated response regulator is bounded. It can never actually exceed this constant CP. And there's a way to see that. I think that the simplest way to see that is to understand that although this looks sort of symmetrical, you can turn the system on by phosphorylating and you can turn it off by dephosphorylating it, there's an asymmetry here, because to turn on the system, the histidine kinase has to first autophosphorylate. So if you like, there's sort of a bottleneck here. If you have lots and lots of free response regulator floating around, they're waiting in line for the histidine kinase to phosphorylate. So even if you were to micro-inject into the cell an infinite amount of response regulator, you're not going to end up getting an infinite amount of phosphorylated response regulator out. In this limit, where the response regulator is greater than the histidine kinase, which seems to be true, we know it quantitatively for the MZ-OMP-R system, and we know it quantitatively for FOQP. In this limit, this tells us that the total amount of response regulator is roughly the amount of unphosphorylated response regulator plus the amount of phosphorylated response regulator. In other words, the amount of response regulator that's tied up in these complexes with the enzyme we can neglect because it's in low abundance. And in that case, you can see immediately that, in fact, at steady state, the amount of phosphorylated response regulator is going to now, in fact, be independent of the total amount of histidine kinase in the cell. So this is an example of robustness with respect to a parameter, if you like, or insensitivity with respect to a parameter. The amount of histidine kinase is an operating parameter for this circuit. And if that variable changes, this is saying that at steady state, the amount of phosphorylated response regulator is not going to change. Finally, there's this phenomenon I mentioned that really follows from this result, which is that the total amount of phosphorylated response regulator is bounded. And what that says is, in this limit in which you have a very high amount of response regulator, the system has a saturating form. So as you increase the amount of response regulator in the system, you increase the amount of phosphorylated response regulator, but it will level off at a maximal value. And importantly, that maximal value depends on kinetic constants in the system, but that's it. And it depends on the input because these constants depend on the input, exactly. Okay, so the bottom line is in this operating regime, the system is in fact, when it's operating in the saturation regime, is insensitive to the amount of histidine kinase and response regulator protein. And I want to emphasize for the enzymologist, this is not simple Michaelis-Menten enzyme saturation kinetics, right? This is saturating to a value that's independent of the concentration of the enzyme. Okay, this is not an enzyme, this is not a velocity here, this is a steady state concentration of a protein, or of a phosphorylated protein. Okay, so that's the model. So how does that, going back to this question of graded versus stable behavior, I suspect the engineers at least sort of immediately see the point. Once you have a saturating system, you can see why positive feedback isn't going to the system run away, because positive feedback just pushes you up towards saturation. So to say that in words, at low to intermediate signal, where remember, so this constant is controlled by, the signal controls this constant, Cp. So at low to intermediate signal, where this constant is low, the promoter has some unstimulated strength which drives the system into saturation. So it's sitting over here, and now varying the amount of response regulator doesn't really affect the output of the system. On the other hand, at high signal, this constant gets driven up to a higher value. So we were starting over here, we were starting at this point. When we stimulate the system, we shift to this higher curve. Now we're operating at this point. Now increasing the amount of response regulator will drive the system up to a higher, it'll drive it up this curve towards saturation. But you can see now that it's going to always be stable. It can never go unstable, and the system is always in fact going to respond to the input signal. So in fact, it's a simple way of building a stable amplifier from positive feedback. You can't break it. The only way I know to break the circuit and make it go unstable would be to mutate the histidine kinase and say kill the phosphatase activity. You're saying if it was a D to E mutation, is that what you mean? Something. Yes, that would be another way of doing it. I was actually thinking of the other way would be a focused star, but yeah, either one of those, which is something we haven't yet tested. But I sort of, it's almost a tautology, I think, but we're gonna build it anyways. But there are some striking predictions from this model. So the first is that the output is a graded function of the applied stimulus. It's not switch-like. I actually showed you that was true already. It's also saying that autoregulation is unimportant at low to intermediate stimulus. In other words, when the system is over here. That's not saying that when the system is, obviously when the system's off, autoregulation does nothing. But I'm not saying it, that when it's off, autoregulation does nothing. At low to intermediate stimulus, the signaling system is still on. But it's in the saturation regime, and in that case, autoregulation won't matter. At high stimulus, on the other hand, now autoregulation will make a difference, and it will amplify the output. However, even in this regime where autoregulation is important, the amount of histidine kinase is not going to matter. We should be able to go in and vary the amount of histidine kinase and not see a change in the output. And finally, we should be able to see, in fact, the saturating behavior as we vary the response regulator. Okay. So I'm now going to just show you quickly that in fact, these predictions hold up. But I should say from the beginning, we don't measure the amount of phosphorylated response regulator in these experiments. We're doing something indirect. We're measuring gene expression, which is regulated by the amount of phosphorylated response regulator. So if we don't see a change in gene expression, we infer that there was not a change in phosphorylated response regulator. So I think you're saying that there must be a negative feedback loop in addition.
Let's take the feedback.
No, actually, I would say technically, I didn't, although I drew it like that, in fact, we don't know at the this model would not predict it necessarily drives it to saturation. It'll drive it to a steady state point, which is higher. It actually doesn't have to be at saturation, because there's going to be a balance. Well, I would say that I think the way to think of it is that, in fact, there's implicitly a negative feedback loop also, which is this loop. Okay.
But there is a clear prediction for the effect of removing positive feedback, which is
that nothing
dynamic range of the response, right?
Right, and then we have two predictions. It'll do nothing in one regime, and it will have an effect in the other. So to test this, first question. Tim built strains where he removed the positive feedback. So I didn't tell you this, but in fact, the regulation of this operon is controlled by two promoters. There's a constitutive promoter, which is always some fixed strength, and then there's also an autoregulated promoter. So he went in and made a derived strain where he just deleted the autoregulated promoter. And he verified with Western blots that, in fact, the expression levels were the same at high magnesium, and it now was unaffected by magnesium. So he did this in his reporter strains, and then he went back and redid his dose response curves. And as you can see, amazingly, or maybe not amazingly, we in fact don't see any change in the output of this system as we vary magnesium. For autoregulation does nothing. And what surprised us here was that this was true all the way down to 10 micromolar magnesium, which is actually very low magnesium. We were expecting, the model was predicting we shouldn't see an effect, I said, from low to intermediate signal. We expected high signaling to be 10 micromolar magnesium because in the literature on the FOQP system, that's sort of as far as people go when they study the system, or most people go. However, in playing with the system, Tim discovered, or more precisely rediscovered, something that McGuire had discovered some time ago in Salmonella, which is that if you go to extremely low magnesium, so low that the system, it's actually growth limiting for magnesium, certain genes and some, he at least in Salmonella, he claimed some FOQP regulated genes. We find in E. coli that all the FOQP genes we've looked at least, are turned on to are very strongly stimulated. So this little pseudo plateau here was the region that I was that was the plateau from the previous graph, and you can see it as I'm now plotting time because the cells are depleting the magnesium as they grow. The genes are very strongly turned on as they continue to deplete the magnesium. And now you can see that, sure enough, there is a difference between a presence of feedback and absence of feedback on these cells. So autoregulation does matter, but it's precisely in this regime a very strong stimulus. What about the prediction that you can't change the histidine kinase does nothing? So he went back and he made additional strains where he could vary by hand the amount of histidine kinase, FOQ, and he measured it with Western blots. And this was in this regime of growth-limiting magnesium where positive feedback is important, where autoregulation is important. And you can see that the output of the system is insensitive to a substantial change in the amount of FOQ. This is plotting FOQ relative to wild type. So this is down below his detection limit on Western blots. But this is what you see if in a strain where you actually delete FOQ. So the system does indeed seem to be insensitive to the amount of histidine of FOQ in the cell. And finally, he could then go in and test test whether it really is showing the saturation behavior with respect to FOQ. So he went in and varied by hand. He deleted the wild type copy of the FOQ genes, and he varied them by hand off a regulable promoter. And again, measured by Western blots, the amount of FOP, and sure enough, he gets the saturating curve. So at least all of those predictions that the predictions that the model made were able to actually see in the system. So to summarize how we think we understand the FOQP system, it's this combination of a bifunctional histidine kinase, both activating and inactivating. With autoregulation together, they make a simple way of building a stable amplifier from positive feedback. And we tested this only for the POQP system, but we would predict that this should be true for many other two-component systems, not all two-component systems, but other two-component systems which have this simple structure and autoregulation. So that's an open question for the future. Okay, so now I want to switch gears and turn to a different two-component system. This is the MZ amp-hour circuit. And this one I mentioned at the beginning is regulated by extracellular osmolarity. And it regulates two genes which modulate the permeability of the cell, of the outer wall of the cell. And what's really important for what I'm going to talk about is it does this by because the phosphorylated response regulator is binding to regulatory elements upstream of these two promoters. So it's binding the DNA. I'm not going to focus on these genes here. It's been known for some time that the system not only responds to osmolarity, it also responds to procaine, also known as novocaine. So this is an amphipathic compound. People say it disrupts membrane fluidity. I don't think they really know what it's doing, but it's a fact that it modulates this circuit, and it does so in a manner that's strictly dependent on the presence of this histidine kinase MZ. This is arguably, I think you could argue in many ways, it's one of the simplest examples of two-component signaling, and it's really a textbook example. You'll find it in most microbial physiology textbooks that discuss two-component signaling. But one of the difficulties in working with this system is, in fact, the permeability of the expression of these two genes is affected by many, many other environmental conditions. Just about anything you can do to change the environment will affect their expression. And not surprisingly, there's in fact associated with that a rather complicated network of additional regulatory proteins which modulate the expression of these genes. And this is sort of a typical theme in biology. You start out the regulatory circuit, and often you find there are many other regulatory components that are sort of converging also on this system. In a very real sense, this system is at the heart of this regulatory circuit, because if you delete this system, in particular if you delete AMPR, you lose all expression of these two proteins, AMPF and AMPC. However, these additional regulatory proteins are somehow modulating the expression level. And in particular, we recently found in collaboration with Linda Kenny that a second two-component system also strongly regulates expression of these points. So we were interested in trying to follow earlier steps in this signaling pathway. Because if we just monitor the expression of these porins, then we're sensitive to all kinds of changes in these regulatory proteins. And we don't really know whether a signal is coming through this pathway or somehow going through these other regulatory factors. So to do this, or to make at least some progress in this direction, we constructed a fusion of green fluorescent protein to the regulatory protein AMPR. So this is a translational fusion now. It's a protein fusion. It's a hybrid protein. But it's still it's a little bit down in activity compared to wild-type AMPR, but it's still active, and we express it at wild-type levels. So what I'm just going to show you then is that by imaging AMPR, we can see evidence of association with MZ, and also binding, using a trick, binding to DNA, and in particular uses to try and quantify these earlier steps in signaling. So this is, I don't know how well easily you can see this. These are fluorescence micrographs of cells expressing AMPR GFP. So this is a wild-type, otherwise wild-type cell. In particular, it contains MZ. And you can see there's a little fluorescent spot there, and there's maybe a fainter one there. And this is something we see in a fraction of the cells. It's something under the ordinary growth conditions we use, we see maybe 10 to 15% of the cells seem to show these little spots. They're often hard to make out because of this high diffuse fluorescence background, but you can, for example, do a nearest neighbor deblurring where you subtract some of the signal from images just above and below the original plane of focus, and you can see that some of the spots might be a little bit easier to see in this image. If you delete MZ, you never see those spots. On the other hand, if you overexpress MZ, you see an increase in fluorescence at the rim of the cell. You increase MZ expression, and you see an increase in AMPR GFP expression at the rim. It's hard to make out here. I think it's much easier to make out in this image here, where we've again done this deblurring. You can see again this rim stain, and perhaps there's some kind of patchiness around the rim. finally, if we overexpress AMP R, we don't see the spots either. So we can seem to be able to compete out the presence of fluorescent spots by overexpressing non-fluorescent AMP R. So our interpretation is that somehow MZ is causing some kind of association of AMP R, GFP, possibly with itself and presumably also with MZ, at least based on this rim staining here. So to actually use this as a tool, I mean, we get very good at seeing spots in any image if we stare long enough. So we wanted a way of trying objectively measuring the presence of spots. And so we wrote some software where in each cell it basically measures the maximal spot intensity above the background. And then what we can do is we can now modulate the circuit and ask how do these spot intensities vary. So we don't have to do anything by eye. So this is what we find when we grow cells, either a strain with MZ or a strain lacking MZ, and we vary the stimulus, the amount of procaine in the medium. And you can see there's a very strong increase in spot intensity. This is actually quite dramatic by eye, too. The cells are noticeably get very strong AMP R GFP spots when we stimulate with procaine. With osmolarity, on the other hand, we see a very, very weak effect, if at all, when we stimulate with either sucrose or by adding chloride. So at least within this model where this is reporting on association with clustering with MZ, this would suggest that procaine strongly stimulates this clustering, osmolarity doesn't. But whether or not it's literally a clustering, it's clearly a phenomenon that's dependent on the presence of MZ. Sucrose definitely affects expression of the porins. What's not clear, despite what the textbooks say, is whether that's really happening through MZ or through those other regulatory proteins. So the second part, that was actually a surprise that we were seeing those spots, and we don't understand them. But we do know that AMP R should be binding DNA when it's stimulated. So we wanted to see, could we see AMP R GFP binding DNA? And that's actually hard because you have 3,500 copies of AMP R, and however many binding sites you have of AMP R in the chromosome, they're presumably going to be spread around the whole cell, and they're going to be very low fluorescent signals. So at least with our techniques, our abilities, I don't think we can actually see those. So we developed a simple trick, though, for imaging binding to DNA in cells. And we did this by taking advantage of plasmid clustering. So it's well known that many multi-copy plasmids in E. coli are clustered. And the idea was if we arrange so that a GFP-labeled protein will bind to a site on those plasmids, then wherever there's a plasmid cluster, we effectively have a high density of binding sites. So we should be able to now see a GFP spot. So we should be able to see GFP binding by using plasmid clustering to easily generate a high density of binding sites. And this is a very easy way to make a high density of binding sites. Every lab that studies regulatory proteins, DNA binding proteins, they all have plasmids with those binding sites on them. So they don't have to do any fancy engineering to make something like this. What they do need, however, is a functional fusion of GFP to their regulatory protein. And that they may or may not be able to easily make. So this was actually work of Eric Batchelor, another graduate student in the lab. What he did is he engineered a plasmid which contained the binding sites for the AMPF promoter, one of those two porins. And in fact, it turns out there are four binding sites. Each site binds a dimer. He also put on this plasmid a copy of a tandem array of LAC operators, which will bind a CFP-labeled LAC repressor protein. This is a standard trick now in biology for labeling sites on DNA. And so he used this as just a passive marker of the location of plasmids. So in the cyan channel, he can see where the plasmids are, and then he can monitor the extent of YFP association with those plasmids. He also built one for the OMP-C promoter, and then he built a control plasmid which has no promoter. Okay, so this is what you actually see in these various strains. In strains containing MZ and containing this OMPF promoter plasmid, you see both cyan fluorescent spots and yellow fluorescent spots. The same for OMP-C. On the other hand, the null plasmid, you don't see any spots in YFP. So that's consistent with this model that the YFP spots are actually reporting binding to DNA. If you delete MZ. So you have very low levels, if at all, of phosphorylated OMPR. You shouldn't be getting DNA binding. So when you delete MZ, sure enough, you lose those spots in the cell. And finally, as a control for the cyan channel, he also made a plasmid where he had deleted the LAC operators, and then you don't see any cyan fluorescence. Okay, so once again, we can use sort of modify our software now to use this system to spot intensity and use it as a measure of the extent of DNA binding. And something you should appreciate from the beginning is that small changes in DNA binding activity can have huge effects on promoter activity. So for example, under ordinary growth conditions, at the OMPF promoter, some fraction of the four binding sites are already occupied. In fact, it's sort of maximal activity, it's presumably two out of the four. So so then a twofold change in that case would actually be full repression of the promoter. So in fact, small changes in DNA binding activity we would expect to translate to very strong changes in gene expression. So Eric went back and using this system, once again, looked at changes of the input stimulus. And so blue is the control plasmid, and then red and green are the OMPF and OMPC promoters. And once again, if you change procaine, you see a very strong increase, as you'd expect from increasing and binding to DNA. For the case of sucrose and osmolarity, you actually do see an effect, and it seems to be real. He tried very hard to make that effect go away, and he couldn't. So as far as we know, it really is a real effect. There does seem to be a small increase in OMPAR binding to DNA in response to osmolarity. But it's much, much weaker than procaine. And something I forgot to say at the beginning is that these conditions of sucrose and procaine, the corresponding conditions give the same level of output for the system, the same level of porin expression. So when we're comparing, say, 210 millimolar sodium chloride and 15 millimolar procaine, they're giving the same or comparable levels of porin expression. So it's not simply, the difference here is not simply an issue of how strongly they're stimulating the promoter. So to come back then to this picture, I think what we've developed a new and relatively simple method for visualizing protein DNA binding in vivo. Essentially, I think all you need is a functional fusion of GFP to the regulatory protein of interest. With that, using that functional fusion in the context of OMPAR GFP, we saw this odd localization of OMPAR GFP in the cell, which seems to be MZ dependent. And it's something we don't understand, but it clearly seems to be correlated with stimulation of the circuit. And by analyzing both binding to DNA and this MZ dependent localization, in both cases it seems to suggest that while procaine is a strong stimulus, and I didn't show you additional data where we actually did kinetics. It's actually a strong stimulus, and it's a very fast response. So it's presumably fairly direct in its effects on MZ. In contrast with that, osmolarity, it seems that the bulk of the system, by these measures, the bulk of the response does not seem to be going through MZ, if it goes through MZ at all. I think it really raises a question here of whether MZ is even detecting osmolarity at all in the system. And we would suggest or hypothesize that, in fact, the bulk of the effect of osmolarity is somewhere in here, changing these regulatory proteins, possibly still in affecting the ability of OMPAR phosphate to bind DNA through these regulatory proteins. That's still, I think, an open question. Okay, so for the last part of the talk, I wanted to turn to actually more of an applied problem, but I first wanted to start out with sort of the general part of the motivation for us. And that's, if you step back and remember, there are a lot of these two-component systems in the cell. They're actually in E. coli. They're roughly 30 distinct two-component systems. And if you were to compare, take two of them. So here's histidine kinase 1, toxic response regulator 1, has output 1 and signal 1, and similarly here's a second one. Then the natural question to ask is there a crosstalk? Or what controls the presence or absence of crosstalk? And you could get crosstalk at all possible places here, at the input signals, cross-phosphorylation, and then cross-interaction at different promoters, say, different sites in the DNA. And we've been interested in this question in several different steps. I think it's in E. coli, at least, it seems fairly clear that crosstalk, for example, cross-phosphorylation, seems to be quite rare if it's really happening much at all. But it still raises a very interesting question, which is what's controlling the wiring or specificity there. And there's sort of a side, if you like, engineering question is, can we actually rewire the circuits to change the specificity? But what I'm going to tell you about, because this is something that's further along, is actually changing the specificity input signal. So can we actually select for mutated histidine kinases that respond to new signals? And when we first tried doing this, we actually tried using a two-component system that controlled transcriptional output. And that turned out to be very, very difficult because it's hard to come up with clean ways of screening for a response to a signal. If you screen for a system to be on in the presence of a new signal, you're going to get a lot of mutants which are just locked on. So you then have to counter-select for those that will turn off when you remove the signal. And that actually greatly increases the whole genetic screening process. And sort of the more steps you have in your screening process, the more ways the bacteria can figure out ways of getting out of your screen in an unintended manner. So we wanted to keep the system as simple as possible, and we realized that in fact the best two-component system to use for that, or it seemed, was actually to turn to the chemotaxis circuit. So I don't need the details of the chemotaxis circuit here, but I just wanted to put it up briefly. I used the wrong color coding system on this one. Actually, TA should have been in yellow. This is the histidine kinase. TY is one of the response regulators. This is an oversimplified view of the chemotaxis circuit. But the main thing we're going to focus on is, in fact, a protein which detects signals and feeds into this circuit. And the one that we're going to look at is TAR, which responds to aspartate, or aspartic acid. So the idea here was to use directed evolution to see if we could change the input specificity of TAR. And to do that, the beauty of using the chemotaxis for this is you can't get locked on or locked off mutants, because TAR receptors that are locked on or locked off cannot chemotax. The way the chemotaxis circuit works, it has to be able to detect changes in concentration, because it's swimming up a concentration gradient. It's a little bit like if your nose was locked on for the smell of chocolate or locked off for the smell of chocolate, you could never sniff out the source of chocolate. So in this case, the way the experiment works is actually very simple. We mutagenize the TAR, a library of TAR genes, and put them into E. coli. And we actually, this is sort of just a technical point which makes the screening simpler, we mix it 50-50 with a strain which has wild-type TAR. And one of them is, the wild-type TAR is non-fluorescent. The strains that contain these mutagenized library of TAR, we make fluorescent, so we can kind of keep track of the two of them. We mix them together. We paint them along a line on a plate of soft agar, which the bacteria can swim on. And at the other end of the plate, we painted the target attractant that we want them to swim to. Although I drew this so it looks like a linear gradient, in fact, it's a gradient set up by diffusion, so it's really an exponential gradient. So we wait, we look to see, we harvest the bacteria that managed to swim up the gradient, and then we can take those and do additional rounds of mutagenesis and start the cycle over again. So, in fact, we've succeeded now in getting this to work for a number of different compounds. I'm just going to show you one, which was changing the attractant from aspartic acid to phenylalanine, which is sort of, I think, kind of an impressive feat, given that this is a rather dramatic side change in the side group from this carboxyl to this hydrophobic, this aromatic ring. So this is an example of this mutant now on a gradient, comparing the mutant to the wild type, where if we initially deposited a culture of the wild type strain or the mutant strain at these points in the presence of this gradient, and you can see that the wild type just spread out isotropically, whereas the mutant swam in a directed fashion up the gradient of phenylalanine. So, interestingly, it seems that when people do these kinds of directed evolution experiments, if you look in the literature, and people have done this in other contexts, changing the activity of enzymes against different substrates, for example, in many of the examples that people have done, they find that you go through the enzyme becomes more promiscuous. If you don't demand that the enzyme lose its or protein loses its activity against the original substrate, then what you end up selecting for is an enzyme that still has a strong activity for the initial substrate, but it becomes more promiscuous. It can now process these other substrates that you present to it. We did not find that for the case of chemotaxis, for the chemoreceptor. In this case, We quantified the response by using a standard assay called a capillary assay. You simply count how many bacteria can swim into a capillary tube that's filled with the attractant. So green is the mutant, blue is the wild type. Here you can see the wild type in blue has no response to phenylalanine, but as expected has a strong response to aspartic acid. The mutant, on the other hand, has the strongest response to phenylalanine and has a very, very weak response to aspartate. So there's really been a switch in specificity in this case. So we can also actually, the structure for tar is known, bound to aspartic acid. So we can go back and look at that structure and look at some of the mutations, and in particular what the mutations were in the binding pocket. And there were two mutations in the binding pocket. There was a tyrosine to phenylalanine change. But more interestingly, there is an arginine to tryptophan change. And this arginine was known to be very important for hydrogen bonding to the side chain carboxyl. And so it's sort of pleasing to see that it went from this positively charged group to this hydrophobic group, which is very likely doing some kind of pi stacking, perhaps, near the tryptophan. It's certainly presenting a hydrophobic environment for this aromatic ring. We went back by site-directed mutagenesis, and we found that, in fact, both of these changes were necessary for the response. But both of these two changes alone were not sufficient. And in fact, there were 10 additional mutations in the protein, all of them outside the binding pocket. And we know that some of those 10 are important for maximal activity, but we don't know, we haven't gone back to actually figure out which of those are. So where are we going with this? Well, we succeeded in getting it to work for a number of different compounds. We improved the response to targeted glutamic acid, a number of other amino acids, also including nitrophenylalanine, and most recently something that isn't even an amino acid, phenylacetic acid, we've been able to get a response to. And sort of where we're hoping to be able to go with this is actually to walk tar through the protein structure landscape starting from aspartic acid and walk it to some more interesting compound, and do that by using a sequence of compounds which would correspond to small changes in the structure. So we, in some sense, guide the mutagenesis process through this very large space of possible protein sequences to get to some interesting compounds. And as far as where we hope to go, well, this is one way of actually building new biosensors, which will proteins which respond to new signals. But in particular, what we're trying right now are compounds for which other people engineered E. coli for bioremediation. So for example, organophosphate pesticides. So the idea is, can we actually then re-engineer the E. coli to swim towards the target that it's trying to degrade? So I talked about three two-component systems and really sort of a tiny part of each one of those. And of course, I hope you didn't get the impression I'm the only one who works on these systems. As a large group, we depended on the work of many, many other people who really studied these systems in detail. There are lots more examples. Many of these are less well studied, so we have lots to do as far as this program of trying to compare and contrast different two-component systems with the ones that we've already looked at. But as far as the current and future directions where I think we're going in this subject, there's this area which I would call the cell biology of two-component systems, really trying to look at the spatial localization of the regulatory proteins and trying to understand where they are in the cell and to what extent their spatial localization is important, and also trying to use their spatial localization as a tool for quantifying steps in the process. There's also lots to do as far as modeling these systems. I mentioned autoregulation. There's another very interesting class, more complicated class two-component systems, which many people are in their hearts here at Santa Barbara, phosphorelays. And I think there are a lot of interesting modeling possibilities for the different phosphorelays. And then there's this direction of really trying, I like to think of it as in some sense ultimately trying to test our understanding of these circuits by evolving them and possibly also engineering them by rational design to make new circuits. So trying to actually, I mentioned changing crosstalk, actually making circuits, their topology, talk to new regulatory proteins. Or, as I mentioned in the case of chemotaxis, actually changing the inputs. So I just want to mention the people who did the work. Eric Batchelor was my first graduate student. He did all the work on MZ-OMPAR and actually much more work than I talked about here today on MZ-OMPAR. Paige Durr did all the work on chemotaxis. And although that was seems like a very simple screen, it was really took a huge amount of determination for her to get that working. There's a some ways our failures, I think, were almost more interesting in that story. A lot of things which didn't work, the reasons why they didn't work, I think were actually sort of interesting but non-publishable. Tim Yashiro did all the work on FOQP, and Albert, I did to mention, is working on this question of cross-phosphorylation. Our collaborators are Eric Boder on the chemotaxis work, Linda Kenny and Tom Sohabi on different aspects of the MZ-OMP-R system, and we've had lots of help in different projects from my colleagues at Penn. And with that, thank you for your attention. I think I think that's a good guess. And in fact, I didn't mention we actually did see increase in promiscuity for cysteic acid, which you would argue is perhaps a smaller change. After all, it's a sulfonate group instead of a carboxyl. In that case, that was the one case where we saw to a cysteic acid. In that case, we didn't see a drop in activity to aspartic acid. That was the one case. However, improving it to glutamate. So tar already has a fairly strong activity to glutamate. It's much less than aspartate, but it's still fairly strong. Improving it to glutamate still showed a very strong drop in aspartate. So I don't know. It may be difficult without actually getting structures for all these to rationalize it. But I guess I imagine that in general, this may also be telling us, though, that the sort of structural requirements to get this, what's believed to be a subtle conformational change, I guess the current model is a slight shift in the two alpha helices, or the piston model that are crossing the membrane, that it sort of has, it's very tightly constrained for a given amino acid. So somehow it's not nearly as plastic as you might have thought, which would allow it to become promiscuous. What surprised us, though, is that I would have thought, if I had known that ahead of time, I would have thought this was hopeless, because I would have thought if it's not plastic from that point of view, we never would have got. You know, these libraries weren't that large. I didn't tell you the sizes. They range from 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 8th in diversity, which is really not that large compared to the total number of changes that could have been made. So I think, I don't think at the moment I can make a general statement about what it implies for the protein structure. We haven't gone back and. That we haven't for that. So for other ones, so for N-methyl aspartate, it was 3 amino acid changes. We don't know if those are minimal, though, but none of them are in the binding pocket. So it's kind of hopeless from a rational design point of view right now, I think.
Do you think anyone quantify, I think you're talking about these differences in the chemical state, right? And on the other hand, there's presumably the time it takes to evolve.
I guess that's our assumption, is that if the jump were too large, then there's no way we would need too many amino acid changes for it to be present in our libraries of even of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 8. So, I mean, that's our intuition, but, you know, it's. So I didn't go into that in detail. So in fact, for phenylalanine, in fact, for all of ours, we do just one additional round, and then we stopped because we already did well at that point. Yeah. What was time consuming was swimming up the gradients just to purify that. We took 4 rounds of kind of we call it racing to enrich for the mutants. But the actual mutagenesis rounds we used, and those were just 2 rounds. We could in principle do that.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's a similar problem since
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm using the term only as functional output. From the point of view of binding, that's quite possible. Yeah. That's right. I mean, really, this is much more stringent because we were not selecting for binding. We were selecting for a functional receptor. But that was not the only change. I mean, I don't think I can claim that only the changes in the binding pocket are important for binding, because right, I don't know how the geometry of the binding pocket changed by those changes outside the binding pocket. So I wouldn't assume that was the only thing that affected binding. You're saying if they bound, that's possible. I don't know if that's. I mean, we might be able to use with our mutant. Now there's a tryptophan in the binding pocket. We might also just be able to use. I was thinking we could use tryptophan fluorescence at least, or something like that. Maybe that would be. If it binds, you mean? Yeah, yeah. In that, we get, as you said, we could test that fairly easily. Yeah, yeah. We haven't done that. It's a good idea.
Another question.